We're now going to hear from Dr. Thomas Deppner how we can utilize measures of solute removal to give us a sense of the adequacy of the dialysis treatment.
Dr. Himmelfarb, and thanks for inviting me to speak to you about dialysis adequacy. I was just flipping through the syllabus and found that my I'd like to give you the opportunity of getting those that set of slides by simply emailing me, and I will send them to you. I'm not sure why they didn't appear. It wasn't the fault of the organizers, but since I did go to the trouble of making a set, it doesn't include all the slides that I will show today because some of them have proprietary information, but most of them are included. We're living in kind of an exciting time in the year 2002 because the results of the HEMO study were published this year, or were revealed this year, both to the study investigators who were blinded for the five-year duration of the study and to the public in general. I will touch on those results briefly at the end of this discussion, but will not have a chance to really go into it in depth, and would invite you to the sessions on Friday and Saturday where the HEMO results will be discussed in more detail. My interest in adequacy stems perhaps from this information that I extracted from our own network, Network 17, which is the Northern California Trans-Pacific network of dialysis centers around the country. And they listed all of these parameters that we should be following or looking at is at indices of quality of care. And the thing that seemed to be missing from this list was a measure of the dialysis itself. And it seemed as though that should be a major concern of all of us, yet at that time it was not even included in the list of what was considered to be important features of a quality of care program. Now what I'd like to do is to focus on concentration of solutes. Toxic solutes, we believe that uremia, part of our therapy, is a toxic state from the accumulation of solutes that are normally excreted and which are toxic to the patient. Now the reason I focus on this is that we have in recent years been paying a lot of attention to clearance, and clearance seems to now have a predominant position in our minds as an index of adequacy of dialysis. But it's only because the other technique, that of measuring the toxin levels directly, has failed that we have had to turn to the concept of clearance as a surrogate for toxin concentrations. And I think it's important for you to keep in mind that it is a surrogate. It has limitations, as Dr. Peterson has already shown you, and that we have to constantly look at how the clearance correlates with these toxin concentrations. Now, perhaps my insistence on this approach stems from my previous work in the 1980s on toxins themselves, and so in a sense I have seen the enemy, and here it is. This is a spectrum of solutes that were extracted from normal serum at low pH using a non-ionic resin. So these are substances that bound to the resin at low pH, and presumably some of these were bound to serum albumin, so they were extracted from the albumin in normal serum versus uremic end-stage renal disease serum. This is a single patient, representative patient, who was considered to be well dialyzed at that time in the late 80s. But what is not shown here, and I fault the way we depicted this in 1987, is that the amount of serum that was required to be loaded onto the column to give us the peaks in the normal was five times what we had to load here. So to try to correct that depiction, I took the liberty of reducing the amplitude of this plot, which I understand probably an average chromatographer would object to, but in fact the peak heights of these substances generally correlates almost as well with the area under the curve, so I think it could be justified. And what we're looking at are a lot of compounds in the serum, both bound to albumin and the ultrafiltrative serum, that are not well removed by dialysis, or at least not completely removed. And each of these peaks may consist of several or even dozens of other peaks. So we may be dealing with dozens or even hundreds of compounds that accumulate in our patients that we're only partially removing with dialysis. So what are these substances? Well, urea and creatinine head the list, and it's important to understand that urea is there at a magnitude that is maybe 10 times that of the nearest competitor. Creatinine is a candidate for that nearest competitor. So urea stands far above all these other solutes in terms of the amount of solute that is accumulating in the patient and, of course, also excreted in the urine. However, urea has been demonstrated to have little in the way of toxicity, except at very high concentrations. So we have to assume that some of these other concentrations, compounds, or perhaps families of compounds, are responsible for the problems that we see in our patients. Most of these are small molecular weight solutes that are not bound to albumin and dialyze easily. Some of them, like the advanced glycosylation end products, are in the middle molecular weight range, and the furan carboxylic acids are more than 90% bound to albumin. So this is what we're trying to deal with. We are able to measure the BUN, we're able to measure the creatinine, but they have failed us. And one of the reasons that they have failed is shown here. This is the National Cooperative Dialysis Study that was done in the late 1970s and reported in the early 1980s. It was the only previous randomized clinical trial of the dialysis dose, and they targeted the BUN, the time average concentration of urea, as their randomized variable. They also looked at time on dialysis, but let's just focus on the BUN here for the time being. And they found that certainly the high BUN group had a poorer outcome. Now, this was a short-lived study of only a few months, and the outcome was hospitalizations and dropout. There were a few deaths, actually no deaths during the study. And they found that the BUN, when it was high, reduced survival. However, they also found that the protein intake, when it was high, improved survival. And of course, if you realize that a high protein intake increases the BUN, you can understand why we're so schizophrenic when we try to interpret a BUN. We have to know exactly how it got there to be able to determine whether it's a risk to the patient. So Dr. Van Holder, who's really an expert on uremic toxins, has written a lot about it, came up with a series of qualifications that should be looked for, characteristics that one should look for in an ideal marker of dialysis adequacy. And I show you these just to indicate that the first three are fulfilled by urea, but the last two are not. So urea is not an ideal marker of dialysis adequacy, and we really can't look at the BUN in our patient to determine how well dialyzed the patient is. And that is demonstrated here with the data from National Medical Care, cross-sectional observational data, looking at just the outcome, risk of death, versus the BUN. And it's a U-shaped curve. You're in bad shape if you have a high BUN, you're in bad shape if you have a low BUN. And the same data from the NCDS, not quite as wide a spectrum, but it has the same trend, i.e. the lower BUNs correlated with poor outcome as well as the high BUNs. So if you look at the NCDS data and look at what correlated with outcome, the most significant correlate was KT over V, a phenomenon or a term that you're quite familiar with. This is basically a measure of urea clearance rather than urea levels. BUN also correlated, so did PCR. If you put these two together, you end up with KT over V. So by looking at these simultaneously, we're really looking at urea clearance and eliminating the problem of trying to distinguish why the BUN is elevated. Time on dialysis also correlated with outcome, but the p-value was 0.06, so that debate still rages as to whether time really is a factor. My own personal feeling about this is that since they randomized the BUN levels, those patients who were dialyzed for longer periods of time probably had lower concentrations of other solutes that diffuse less readily than urea. But that's just an opinion. Now, why do we focus on KT over V? Well, Dr. Gotch in his seminal paper in 1985 showed that there was a step-like function in the outcome, probability of success, as the KT over V increased from approximately 0.8 to 0.9. He set 1.0 as the target above which he didn't expect a whole lot of additional improvement. But again, remember, this is a very selected small number of patients studied for a short period of time. And if we take that same data, these are exactly the same data, and just plot them in a different way, using the urea reduction ratio, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, as a surrogate for K2RV, as a surrogate for clearance, and look again at the probability of failure here, and just put a line through the data, it ends up crossing the x-axis here at about 0.68, which corresponds to a K2RV of about 1.3. Now that's interestingly close to the Doki standard now of 1.2 as a minimum or 1.3 as a target. However, there's a lot of scatter here, and it's difficult to know exactly precisely where that number crosses the x-axis based on this set of data. So let's look at clearance. We've said that clearance correlates best with outcome. Clearance of urea, not concentration, but clearance. What is a clearance? A clearance is a removal rate divided by a concentration, i.e., as the removal rate increases, or as the concentration increases, the removal rate increases. So by dividing by the concentration, we remove the effect of the concentration, and we also remove the effect of the removal rate. We end up with a constant that is a function of the solute and the dialyzer. We call this a first order relationship, and I just contrast it with a zero order relationship here, where the rate of removal is a constant independent of the concentration. First order, where the rate of removal is proportionate to the concentration, and another example, a second order phenomenon, where the rate of removal is proportionate to the square of the concentration. This is, we're familiar with this phenomenon. The generation of urea by the liver is a zero order process. It has nothing to do with the concentration. It's just simply a constant, more related to diet. And looking again at this relationship, removal rate divided by concentration, that turns out to be a flow, which is what you're all familiar with. We often think of clearance as an equivalent flow, but in fact, I think it's more useful to think of it as a removal rate factored for the concentration. Now, to make a long story short, I'm not going to go through the derivation of this, but the bottom line is this expression, KT over V, which is a clearance. K is the German symbol for clearance, much like EKG, I guess. Time is time on dialysis, and V is the volume of urea distribution in the patient, generally equivalent to total body water. And that measure of clearance can be obtained by just measuring a pre- and a post-dialysis BUN and taking the log ratio. And this will hold true if there's no urea generation during dialysis or volume change during dialysis, which, of course, is not true in most cases. So this is an oversimplification, but it emphasizes the fact that this term, the clearance, can be obtained without actually measuring K, T, or V, and by simply measuring a pre- and post-BUN. These are the major determinants of K, T, over V. Now, if we look at observational data, even 10 years ago, there's a very clear relationship between K, T, or V and mortality. So this supports the findings of the NCDS, in that as one increases K2V, mortality rates go down. Although this is observational data, and we can't really say that it's a cause and effect relationship. So how does K2V differ from the usual measure of renal clearance? We've become so reliant on serum creatinine, creatinine clearances, urea levels in our patients before they come to dialysis. Why can't we continue to do that? Well, first of all, the solute now has moved from creatinine to urea. The time element, since we're dealing with an intermittent process, patients dialyze three times per week, we can no longer use techniques that are adapted for continuous processes. So we look at it per dialysis, the clearance per dialysis, and the denominator is V instead of body surface area. And the reason for using V is that previous relationship I just showed you is that by measuring the pre- and the post-dialysis BUN, we end up with KT over V. V is close enough to body size and is an index of size that correlates with surface area very closely, and so we feel it's a reasonable denominator. However, there are some problems. Now, why don't we use the creatinine? Well, the creatinine, I'm sure you're aware, correlates inversely with mortality, with death. So as the creatinine rises, shown here on the x-axis, the risk of death goes down. This is just the opposite of what we would expect in the patient pre-dialysis, and it's a very powerful phenomenon, even more powerful than the PCR or the K2RV itself. So there's something about creatinine
levels creatinine generation in the patient that gives the patient an advantage. And I don't think we completely understand this phenomenon. There is something about muscle mass. Patients who have more muscle mass seem to be protected from risk of death. And it's possible, I suppose, that the muscle could be a sink for uremic toxins. Certainly it doesn't stand out as a possible source of uremic toxins, since more muscled people are less at risk. But I think this simply points out why we can't use the serum creatinine once the patient's in the end stage of renal failure. Now, it's also important to understand that the clearance tells us about the ratio of concentrations pre and post dialysis, not about their absolute level. Because these two patients, one who starts out with a B1 of 50 and ends up at 25, and the other at 150 and ends up at 75, have the same slopes, the same K over V, and since time is the same, they both have the same KT over V. So KT over V is not a measure of solute concentration. It's a measure of clearance. Now, Dr. Clark has already gone through this, so I'll mention it briefly. I guess there's some value in repetition. If we look at the dialyzer itself, there's no dial on the machine that tells us that we can turn up the clearance, right? If you want the clearance to be doubled, you can double the time, but you can't double the clearance. The only thing you can do is change the flow rates or change the dialyzer itself. And fortunately, there is a relationship between flow and clearance, which is based on this logarithmic decline in the concentration gradient across the dialyzer, along the hollow fibers, as you go from one end of the dialyzer to the other. And that gradient, of course, is the driving force for removal of solute. Shown here, the KOA times the log mean concentration gives you the flux. The Michaels equation, which Dr. Clark has already shown you, which was worked out in the 1950s based on thermodynamics, has proven useful as a way of converting blood flow, dialysate flow, and the dialyzer KOA into a clearance. So we have the ability to do that. It requires a calculator or something, but it can be done very, very quickly and easily. Similarly, you can back out the KOA by rearranging that same equation and putting clearance on this side. So you can measure the clearance, measure the blood and dialysate flow rates, and determine the KOA for your dialyzer, with the stipulation that there may be some effects of dialysate flow, as Dr. Clark has already shown you. The expressions of dose, too, have different meanings. You're probably familiar with the prescribed dose and the delivered dose. The prescribed dose is very simple. It's just how much clearance you're prescribing, how much you write down in your order. The delivered dose is determined from the pre and post dialysis BUN, very, very separate phenomena. The predicted dose is something that we've used in the HEMO study, because we realize that what you prescribe is not necessarily what you get. You can write an order for blood flow of 400 mils per minute, but you may only get 300. And so the predicted dose is based on what actually occurred, based on what was measured at the time of the dialysis. Now, I've simplified things by using that log pre over post ratio to get KT over V. And it's important to realize that that was a simplification, ignoring urea generation during dialysis and volume changes during dialysis, which have a fairly significant effect, up to 30%. So the true equation is a little bit more complicated, and that's the change in the amount of urea in the single body space here. We're looking at the single compartment model with respect to time is due to the generation minus removal. G, the generation of urea by the liver, minus the removal, in this case, both by the dialyzer and the native kidneys, which is the product of the clearance and the concentration. If we solve that equation, we come up with a little bit more complex relationship than the log ratio. However, it's solvable. And what this equation says is that we can calculate a concentration at any given time during or between dialyses based on these four variables: the volume, the rate of filtration, the time, and the generation rate. So it is possible to calculate the concentration if you know all of those variables. This leads us to some degree of anxiety, which I point out is a primitive impulse that you shouldn't have to worry about it. If you're concerned about complexity, you can go to something simpler. Population studies is a reasonable substitute. And just to show you that there's a mathematical relationship here, if we ignore generation and and volume changes. Since this equation is already known to you from the previous slide, the urea reduction ratio is simply the change in urea concentration divided by the concentration at the beginning of dialysis. If we substitute into these equations, we come up with this expression. So there is a strict mathematical relationship between the two, again, in the simplified setting. Now, I apologize for showing you this equation again, but I want to point out that this equation allows us to calculate a concentration. But that's not what we do when we do urea modeling. We have the concentration. We measure the concentration. What we want to know is the volume of distribution and the generation rate. We know the clearances. We can put the clearances in here. So we want to go backwards. And that's what the process of urea modeling is all about. We simply reverse the process, which is a little bit more mathematically complex and requires a computer rather than a pocket calculator because the processes have to be done by iteration. But it is possible to back out from a given concentration pre and post dialysis, the ultrafiltration rate, the dialyzer clearance, the generation. We can then calculate the generation rate and the volume of distribution and come up with a KT over V. Now that's what happens during dialysis, pre and post BUN. We also need to know how much urea is being generated, and that we get from this interval between dialyses. So here between dialyses, both the residual clearance that the patient has, native kidney clearance, and the generation rate become important factors. Now, they are both also operative during this period of time, but since it's so short, changes in these parameters really don't affect the KTRV much. Now, that requires three BUN measurements, and as you know, we only measure two. We can get away with this because the computer can simply give us our concentrations based on that equation I showed you over a period of a week, and then match the pre-dialysis concentration with the measured pre-dialysis concentration. Using an iterative process, we can come up with a generation rate that matches these two points. So we really only have to measure a pre and a post. Now what do we do with G? Well, from G we calculate the protein catabolic rate. As you're aware, protein is 16% nitrogen, and so we should be able to directly convert a given urea generation rate to a protein generation rate. We call it a protein catabolic rate. And that relationship is not quite 16%, but is close to it. It was worked out by Dr. Bora at UCSF in 1978. This was based on a small number of patients, but it matched what has been found by other people looking at patients before starting dialysis, and also was close to the 16%, so we don't question it much. Now, of course, there's a relationship between PCR, as I mentioned, found in the NCDS study, and outcome, and it was as powerful, if not more powerful, predictor of mortality. I don't like that word predictor because it gives you a cause and effect sense, but it's used by the statisticians. But if you acknowledge that this is just a correlation here, those patients who have low protein catabolic rates have a higher risk of death. To me as a clinician, it doesn't really matter too much whether this is a cause and effect relationship. I know that if I measure the PCR and I find it low, my patient's in danger. And so there should be some attention given to why the PCR is low and try to correct it. And the urea kinetic modeling, specifically the formal urea kinetic modeling, allows you to do that, whereas the simplified methods do not. Now, if we look at the actual data, how does the single apartment model that we just outlined, that complex equation, predict what we actually measure during dialysis? Well, it doesn't do a very good job. It overestimates the BUN during dialysis and ignores this obvious rebound in concentration post-dialysis in this patient given a high efficiency treatment over a period of 2.5 hours. So that brings us to the solute disequilibrium phenomenon, which you're all familiar with, I'm sure, but it's important to distinguish the two types. The first is the classic diffusion gradient type that appears among body compartments during a hemodialysis treatment and then dissipates within a few minutes afterwards, usually up to 30, maybe 60 minutes afterwards. And then there is a diffusion, a flow-dependent type. This is the diffusion model, a classic two-compartment model that Dr. Clark has already shown you. And the key feature of this model is this term KC, the intercompartment diffusion coefficient, if you would want to call it that. It's the actual mass transfer coefficient. It's a measure of how rapidly solutes move between the two compartments, and it's a function of the solute, so it's going to differ from one solute to another. The rest of the model looks like the one I just showed you. The differential equation, instead of G minus the single term here, we have another term thrown in, and we also have another equation to describe what's going on in this compartment. And so instead of coming up with that complex equation, we're unable actually to solve this explicitly and have to use numerical techniques. So for that reason, it's not used as a clinical tool. Now, the other type of disequilibrium is flow-related disequilibrium. And here I show you the concentrations of urea in varying shades of red. It's important to understand that there is a loop here that goes through the heart and lungs and back through the AV fistula that has a circuit time of about 10 seconds on the average. Now, normal circuit time on the average is about 1 minute. So this is flowing about 10 times the flow through the rest of the body on average. And the rest of the body can be thought of as multiple parallel circuits, which have varying flow rates to tissue mass ratios. And when the flow rate is low and the tissue mass is high, that ratio is low. And as a consequence, urea tends to sequester there. A good example would be resting muscle during dialysis. And as a consequence, the process of dialysis shown here is impaired. And you can see that just by the shade of the color coming into the dialyzer on the arterial side here is always very fairly dilute because of this recirculation phenomenon. It's exaggerated a bit, but just to show the point. This loop is called the cardiopulmonary loop or cardiopulmonary recirculation. So this phenomenon contributes to the rebound post-dialysis. There's also the concept of the equilibrated post-dialysis BUN, which is important to keep in mind because the HEMO study used this as their index, their targeted randomized variable. And it's shown here as the point where after you've allowed the urea to equilibrate, the concentration extrapolated backwards, correcting for changes in volume and urea generation, slight changes during this period of time. This is about 30 minutes here, up to an hour, it's complete. Now, if you look at the rebound more carefully, there are several components. The first one, is, of course, is access recirculation, which we should not see in about 95% of our patients, but unfortunately about 5% of them do have access recirculation. So we have to be careful to avoid this when we measure the post-dialysis BUN. And then the next component is the cardiopulmonary recirculation, that fast-moving loop, which is, dissipates about 2 minutes after stopping dialysis. But it accounts for a third to a half of the total rebound. The rest of it is a mixture of flow-related and diffusion-related disequilibrium that lasts up to an hour post-dialysis. And we're talking about urea here. The rate equation was developed by the HEMO investigators. Drs. Dagirdas, in conjunction with Dr. Schneiditz in Austria, came up with an equation from their own data and applied it to the HEMO data, and it seemed to apply, it seemed to adequately predict the rebound, and it allowed us to calculate EKT over V, which is the equilibrated post-dialysis BUN. An easy way to think of that is that you would simply wait and draw the blood, let's say, an hour after dialysis, get the equilibrated value for the post-dialysis BUN, and then go through the modeling process, giving us a better measure of what's actually happening in the patient. Now, we also have standards for hemodialysis. The old NCDS guideline of 1.0 has been jacked up to 1.2, and currently the target is recommended at 1.3 by Doki with a minimum of 1.2 based on several considerations, one of which, of course, is the accumulated experience from cross-sectional observational data, suggesting that we need more than what was required back in the 1970s. That correlates with the URR of 0.65. Now, there is a problem, however, in that we also have a consensus that for peritoneal dialysis, we only need a total of 2 per week. So if we multiply the 1.2 per dialysis, and it's important to understand that this ratio of volumes, clearance volume to the patient's total body water, is 1.2 per dialysis. We can multiply that by 3 to get the total per week. we end up with a requirement for hemodialysis that's almost twice that for peritoneal dialysis. And these are both based on observation, simply looking at mortality rates, outcomes. We have assumed that they're approximately the same. Now, there is some adjustment of this perhaps with the ADAMAC study, but we still have the problem of trying to reconcile why we have to give more dialysis as expressed as occurrence than in hemo compared to peritoneal. Now, one way of explaining this is to look at what happens when you increase dialysis frequency, since continuous dialysis is the ultimate increase in frequency to infinity. And as you do that, you can see that as the frequency increases, the requirement for K to V goes down if you want to maintain the same time average concentration. This is of urea. Well, actually, it's of urea expresses an ideal solute without any disequilibrium. This would be the single compartment model prediction. So even without disequilibrium, we can predict that the efficiency of the dialysis improves as you increase the frequency. But if you throw in the KC value, that intercompartment mass transfer resistance to diffusion, as that value goes up, the resistance to diffusion goes up, we end up with a steeper relationship. Not quite as steep as what we would like to see for patients on peritoneal dialysis, but it's steeper nonetheless. And so if we carry that to its logical conclusion, and consider that we're dialyzing another solute that dialyzes just as well as urea, a small molecular weight compound, for instance, but doesn't diffuse in the patient very well, we come up with a relationship that now explains why the peritoneal dialysis patient requires more dialysis than the hemodialysis patient, i.e. intermittent dialysis is less efficient than continuous dialysis. And notice that with each of these curves, each of them reaches kind of a plateau here, which we could call the continuous equivalent of intermittent dialysis. So for this patient whose K2V is 3.6, the continuous equivalent would be somewhere around 2 or 2.2. Using that concept, it's possible to plot the continuous equivalent of clearance on this axis versus the single pool K2V. And as you can see, these are all curvilinear lines. If we look at the 3 per week isopleth, as we go to 1.2 per dialysis, our current minimum standard, that equates to a 2.0 a continuous K2V for peritoneal dialysis and helps to explain phenomenon. Now, this solute X has a KC of approximately 100. Another thing that we can extract from this is that as you increase K2V per dialysis, if we limit it to 3 times a week, and even if we increase the time to 24 hours per day, we still reach a plateau that's far below what we can achieve with continuous dialysis. Whereas if you increase it to 7 times per week, the efficiency improves, and as we go up in time on dialysis, and Dr. Paratos in Toronto is approximately here, we can achieve much more. It's a more efficient way of dialyzing. So the efficiency of dialysis seems to be reduced by high-efficiency dialyzers, somewhat paradoxical finding. That is, if you dialyze intensely for short periods of time, your efficiency is going to go down. And that is illustrated, I think, very nicely in this study by Spalding, published last year, looking at phosphate kinetics during long and short dialysis. This is an intense short dialysis where the phosphate level fell below the normal range, presumably putting the patient at risk for symptoms of hypophosphatemia, and with a slight prolongation of the treatment, with a slower clearance, actually more phosphate is removed. Now, I'm going to stop there and just simply say something about the HEMO study. The HEMO study was designed to look at this question of increasing K2V and increasing flux to determine whether it would affect outcome. Now, we have those cross-sectional data suggesting that it would, but there's also a plateau in those data, and the question is, where does that plateau occur? The HEMO study separated patients on the basis of eKTRV, but you can express that as single pool KTRV as well, and here the eKTRV separation is quite good. The average was approximately 1.6 for the standard dose patients and approximately 1.5 for the high dose patients. The beta 2 microglobulin clearance wasn't quite as separate, but it was quite distinct, the average being above 20 and close to zero for the low flux group. And just in comparison with the single pool KTRV in the NCDS, which did not randomize the patients on the basis of KTRV, but rather on the basis of BUN, you can see there really wasn't a very good separation. And in fact, the most important thing, of course, is that the patients were not randomized on this basis. The outcome is shown here. This data was presented at the NKF meetings last spring, so I don't hesitate to show it to you, but you will hear much more about this on Friday and Saturday. That the time to death by KTRV groups were exactly the same, the p-value being 0.52. So in other words, there was no improvement in outcome expressed as survival in patients given a fairly high dose of dialysis expressed as KTRV. Likewise, for the high flux, there is an apparent slight difference that was not statistically significant. So we have to conclude from these data that increasing the dose above what is currently considered to be an adequate dose established by DOCI will not be expected to improve survival in the average patient treated with hemodialysis three times per week. Now, in conclusion, I would people ask me, what can we conclude from all of this? I would have to conclude that uremia is a more complex state than what we had imagined previously. By dialyzing the patient, we remove life-threatening toxins. Patients who would die probably within a period of weeks if they didn't have dialysis obviously are allowed to live, but they are left behind with this residual syndrome consisting of slowly accumulating solutes, including beta 2 microglobulin, some of the higher molecular weight species, and comorbidity, which may have nothing to do with the efficiency of dialysis as a cause of death. So in conclusion, I would leave you this thought from an old expert on the subject. Thank you.
It was an excellent presentation. We have time for a few questions. I guess, Tom, in your discussion of adequacy, I will tell you in the PD world, we're focusing a little bit on ultrafiltration, not just because of the discussions we just had for middle molecules, but also, you know, volume, et cetera. Your conclusion, you know, make it simple but not simpler. I'm not sure where, if we want to improve outcomes, where we need to go with that. Again, that has to do with the question I asked.
Yes, I share your concern. And I should have prefaced this whole talk with the concern about the mortality rate in patients in the United States still being above 20%. And over the last 5 years, there apparently hasn't been any change in that figure, which is quite a bit higher than observed in other countries. And so I would say that as a result of the HEMO study, which I consider to be a very positive result, we can say that by increasing the dose of dialysis, which has a lot of implications with respect to imposing on patients' time and on the taxpayer's dollar, we can say that that's not going to work. And so we have to look elsewhere. And Dr. Burkhardt is asking, where do we look?
But I think the caveat you said was increasing the dose in the standard way we've been increasing the dose, right?
Right. I think that, to make a long story short, the HEMO data are not inconsistent with the improved outcomes that people have been reporting with more frequent dialysis. Because it was limited to three times a week, and if we had more time, I could show you how, even on a theoretical basis, we should expect a plateau effect in the relationship between clearance and concentration. We know that's true just from our measurements of creatinine clearance in our patients. And also the relationship between concentration and mortality is another curvilinear relationship. So these results are not unexpected, even on a theoretical basis. The question is where the plateau occurred, and I think we've at least established a limit above which it doesn't seem to improve. But where else we should look, I would say frequent dialysis should be looked at, comorbidity should be looked at, clearances of higher molecular weight species. As Dr. Henderson pointed out, the difference between the beta 2 microglobulin clearance of 0 and above 20 was still relatively small when you compare it to the normal glomerulus. So perhaps we should be looking at even more permeable membrane. I would add a caveat, though, is that as you increase the clearance of higher molecular weight species, there may be some desirable solutes that you're removing as well.
Dr. Henderson.
Tom, just a question on the reconciling the disparity in KT over V between PD and hemo. What role do you think the difference in calculation of clearance makes? You know, PD is a time-averaged clearance and changes over the course of an exchange, whereas hemodialysis, clearance is a constant, an instantaneous value. Do you think that plays a role in the disparity that we see in outcome from a given KT over V?
The clearance is a tricky concept. It's a measurement of how well the instrument is performing independent of concentrations. And that's paradoxical because what we're really interested are the concentrations. And of course, during a dialysis, the effectiveness, the efficiency of the dialyzer decreases. The concentration gradient across the dialyzer decreases. The amount of solute removed per minute per unit of time decreases in intermittent dialysis, but not during continuous dialysis. So the effectiveness of the solute removal goes way down with hemodialysis. And the longer you dialyze, the more ineffective it becomes in a single treatment. And you can imagine that if you go out the BUN down to zero, you can increase the time, double it, triple it, whatever, KTRV will double and triple, but there will be no further advantages to that kind of treatment. So intermittent therapy has to be considered in that light, and that's why I like the concept of converting the intermittent clearance to a continuous equivalent. Now, that process is somewhat in its infancy, and I think we have to look at other solutes as well, as you point out, to really know precisely how much better continuous clearance is than intermittent. But I think this is a step in the right direction. So you're right. The way it's calculated, it's still a clearance. And if we think of clearance in the proper light, it all makes sense. But unfortunately, we have this concept that if we have a clearance of 2 and we double it to 4, that somehow we've doubled the reduced in half the concentration and reduced the risk to the patient. And that's just not true.
One further question for you, Tom. The whole KT over V concept assumes that clearance should be normalized against the volume of distribution of urea to get to concentration-dependent toxicity, as you've told us. Some questions have been raised, though, as to whether whether it's really best to normalize clearance against V, given that the volume of distribution of urea is more than just a surrogate for volume. It measures body mass and is certainly a surrogate for nutritional status. And there is some data that people have advanced to suggest that people of different sizes may need different doses of dialysis. So the question I would have is, should we really be looking at KT over V urea, or should we be looking strictly at clearance, KT, and in designing the HEMO study to use KT over V urea, was there enough separation between the groups based strictly on dialytic removal of solute or KT?
A good question. That issue has been raised because of the finding that the outcome of the patient correlates better with KT in some studies than it does with KT over V. And the result of those investigations, I think, has been very interesting. What has come of this is that we've now recognized that V, or body size, correlates independently with outcome. And so the denominator in the expression of KT over V has an independent effect on outcome. And I think it's important to separate those. Exactly why larger patients survive better is not clear. But it's clear that if you have a larger patient and you use the larger V in the denominator of KT over V, that's going to give you the impression of a low effectiveness of the dialysis. So the concept of K through V still holds, and the relationship between mortality and K through V still holds regardless of the size of the patient, but it's at a different plane in larger patients compared to smaller patients. So I think what we've recognized now, and this is information that's available from several different sources, that the size of the patient has something to do with the outcome, that is not clear exactly why that is. I've mentioned the possibility that muscle mass has something to do with it, but obese patients also have a better survival. So some people think it's nutrition. The patients who are bigger have a better nutritional stores, caloric stores, nitrogen stores, that allow them to survive in periods of trouble, for instance, an infected access or something. I don't know. That may be part of it. The idea that muscle may be a sink for toxins is another wild speculation. But this needs further investigation. I think that to just use KT, though, as your index of dialysis adequacy is a mistake. Obviously, larger patients need more dialysis than smaller patients. Otherwise, our pediatric patients would be getting the same amount of dialysis as the adults. A mouse would need the same amount of dialysis as an elephant. So there has to be some normalizing factor. V may not be the best of those.
Thanks, Dr. Debner. Well, I think